Hello and welcome to Eavesdropping at the Movies. I'm Mike.
And I'm Jose.
And today we're talking about Dune Part 2.
Yes.
If you're wondering where our podcast on Dune Part 1 is, we never did one. We have seen the film. We saw it when it came out. We didn't see it together, though. And when the suggestion came up, we should see this together and see it, we never got round to it. It was quite long. I'm not sure that either of us were interested in seeing it a second time. That doesn't mean we didn't like it. You definitely liked it.
I loved it. I have now seen it a second time.
You have. Yeah. I didn't like it very much. I thought I liked Denis Villeneuve, the director. I've liked so many of his films. I love it. He really reminds me of Antoine Fuqua in the way that I've talked about Antoine Fuqua before as having his films look like films should look in my head. They are big and the imagery is impactful and everything is, you know, kind of long lensed and close in and shallow focus and maximum visual impact. Denis Villeneuve shares some of that, I think, his film, and we just saw this in the Birmingham IMAX Digital, where it looked astonishing. The first one, though, I found really boring. The only thing I really remember about it is how disappointed I was that the ending was so brief and nothing, because it was leading into a potential at the time it was a potential sequel, and then it got subsequently greenlit. And the other thing I remember is that it had this amazing special effect where it looked like Timothy Chalamet was actually capable of lifting Josh Brolin up off the floor. It was amazing.
I didn't have any of those things. I think Timothy Chalamet, it holds up very well. I think he's maturing really interestingly. I think in this particular film, you know, he really does look like a man instead of a boy, and, you know, he handles the action sequence as well, and I don't have any problems with that. I think people have, you know, Chalamet like a bee in their bonnet or something. There's something about him that bugs people. And I think, you know, it's maybe just that he's too pretty, though, you know, as he's aging, that prettiness is being lost.
You're very keen on his wonky face.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there is this kind of thing about everyone, you know, about boys and girls, like, kind of, you know, when they're teenagers, it's like kind of they bloom, but they also have like a teenage look, right? And it's very difficult to see how someone with Chalamet's features is going to look as a mature person. And I think now we know he's going to look like this. I mean, you know. he'll age and so on, but
yeah. Well, I mean, I really like him. I liked him in the first one. I like him in this. He's perfect for the role, you know. Although, actually, by this point, maybe even in the first one as well, I don't really buy the age difference between him and Rebecca Ferguson, who plays his mother. She's supposed to be old enough to be his mother. I don't quite buy that, but that's nothing really, because she's also very good. So I don't really mind it. But I mean, I think you're right. He does look older and kind of more filled out and so on in this. And I think he could actually do with maybe being a little bit more boyish. But again, that's kind of by the by. I'm not going to hold that against it. Maybe that's just a personal taste or something. I think this one was a lot better than the first. I think it, having done a lot of the foundation building in the first film, this film is allowed to tell more of an interesting story, and that helps. It's more action-oriented, which I think also helps. And it's just stunningly beautiful to look at throughout. I mean, I wouldn't say, oh, it's got things you've never seen before. But everything you've seen, even if you have seen it before, you haven't seen it look better than this. It is beautiful.
And it's very well judged, actually. You know, there are very few close-ups, and when you get them, you know, they're incredibly impactful.
Yeah.
So and each of the protagonists gets their share, and there's also something iconic about them, actually, the way that Butler looks, or when Florence Pugh shows up with that, you know, metal helmet near the end, right? It's like very, very striking visual imagery, really.
Yeah. So I mean, maybe we should say something about the plot. It obviously continues from the first film. I don't remember the first film all that well, like I say, and this film isn't going to help you out very much if you don't remember the first film very well.
It doesn't matter if you don't remember the first film.
No, but it's not going to help you out into, you know, like, the only thing it really re-explains, really, is the sand walking thing, where you have to walk weirdly on the sand in order to not attract the sandworms that will come and kill you. Anything else is like you, if you're not remembering it, this isn't going to help you out very much, but you will kind of fill in blanks and stuff. But I was kind of on my way through the film. It's an issue for me that I never felt interested enough in anything to have a really invested response to things. The only time, this is a spoiler for the end of the film, the only time I felt a real response was when Paul says, "I'll take your daughter's hand in marriage and then we'll rule the galaxy together," and that'll be, you know, and the daughter is not Zendaya, who he's had a relationship with, he's in a relationship with, who loves him and he loves her. And when she sees him say that, then it's a thing, right? And I went, oh, right, this is a thing. That's the only time in the film when I actually had a response to something. The rest of the time, stuff would happen and I go, okay, that's happened now. I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen and it looked marvellous. And it was, as you say, very well judged. There was a good tone to things. Like, there was nothing wrong with anything. But, and this is, I suppose, extremely personal, I just couldn't bring myself to care about anything.
Oh, well, I did. I mean, I know what you mean, that the big emotional moment is that moment of betrayal, you know, which is a betrayal to ideals, right? It's something that he must do. But actually, now thinking about it, why must he do it, right? You know, so you're wrapped up in this idea of this prophecy and, you know, kind of things must go this way. And I suppose, you know, that interesting moment where he can see the future now and he's got various parallel paths, but this is the only path where his line will survive. So I suppose that's why he must do it. So I've answered my own question.
There were things in the film where I thought, if I get caught up in the details here, I'm not going to have answers to anything, because like, for instance, when he goes and drinks the blue fluid that comes out of the worm, which his mother's drunk at the start of the film, I don't know if I wasn't paying attention to something that explained that he was going there and why he was doing that. What we had was Rebecca Ferguson seeing the fluid extracted from the worm, and then she says, "A guy's going to come here to do this," because it's a thing that women do, apparently, and men don't survive this. "A guy's going to come here to do this, and you have to let him do it." And so that, we clearly... So Paul's going to show up. And then he does, but did we get from Paul why he was going there?
Yes.
Did we?
Yes, there was a conversation beforehand with him and his mother, actually. So it had several components. So there was a conversation with his mother beforehand. There was his refusal to go south because, he had these visions that there would be like all this destruction. And then there was the moment where he decided that, in fact, he had to go south.
The thing about going south, but going south and doing that in particular, was that...
That was, it's that all was tied together.
Yeah. So that's the thing is, I was following all these broad strokes of things, but I don't really, as I say, I didn't really care about what anyone was doing or why they wanted to do it. And the whole, actually, that's not quite true. Early on, and when I say early on, I mean the first kind of hour of the film, maybe, because it's a 2¾-hour film. The story is very simple, and I really enjoyed that. The story is very, very keenly centred on Paul and his mother in the Freeman Society, which is this kind of tribal society resisting the, I don't know if they're called the Empire, but whatever the evil people are called. And they're the ones mining for spice in the north and so on. And they retreat to the south where they can't get them because it's dangerous and sandy and so on. And they're just integrating themselves into this society. And, you know, the Freemen are worried about them. Maybe they're spies. Maybe they're there with the wrong intentions. We don't trust them and so on. They're outsiders. But gradually they work their way into the society and he develops a relationship with the Zendaya character as well. It's quite simple stuff and I really enjoyed it. It was very legible. And as the film goes more and more into the politics and stuff with the King of the Universe character, played by Christopher Walken, and the baddies, you know, who we've seen throughout, but they get more and more involved in the story, and the Austin Butler character, who's one of the baddies, gets more and more involved, I started to lose interest in things. I didn't think it was telling that story as legibly as I needed.
I really didn't have any problems with that. I think, you know, definitely the film changes registers, but I thought in a good way.
Mm.
So I thought, you know, when Butler appeared, I thought it was like gobsmacking, really, because, you know, he's got such a definite look and he's got this marvelous stillness, you know, and he's very sexy in this kind of skinheady, dangerous way. And he's filmed incredibly.
They shot that stuff with infrared cameras.
Right.
The black and whites, which I think was marvellous. Because I think, for me, I don't know if you got the same thing. For me, I think the implication was that on that planet, so their home planet, because they point out the black sun.
Mm.
I think the idea is that sunlight makes things black and white on that planet. Because when they're indoors, it's still in colour.
Mm.
And you see it transition to black and white as they move outside, which I think is interesting. Mm. And it looks astonishing.
It does. So I loved all of that, actually. And, you know, the betrayals and the search for power and, you know, is he the Messiah or isn't he? I mean, it felt kind of, you know, a combination of biblical and medieval, right?
Yeah. Do you feel that there is credibility to the idea that he is a Messiah? The reason I asked that, what I'm asking really is, the character who really believes this is the one played by Javier Bardem.
Yes.
Who is all fingers, all toes, I believe this guy's the Messiah, and there's this prophecy, and he's going to fulfill every part of it. And it becomes kind of, I mean, it is funny, it becomes a joke. It becomes like the you know, the stuff in Life of Brian, where it was, you know, he is the Messiah, everything he does, he is the Messiah, and it's funny every time he says that.
Yes.
But do you think the film really actually allows for the possibility that there's, yes, something real to supernatural, to the Messiah stuff?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes, of course. Because, you know, the mother believes as well, but she believes and she doubts, right? So every time he survives one of the tests or one of the stages in his becoming the Messiah, you can see the relief on her face, right? Like, so, and you get the Charlotte Rampling character saying, you know, there's definitely a Messiah, but there's different possibilities. One of the possibilities is Butler, right? You know, so actually, there's also that tension at the end, like, who's going to survive that? Because, you know, Butler is also a definite possibility.
Right? Yeah.
You know, so I was quite taken with that. I mean, I thought the actors were marvelous and it looked smashing and it moved great, and it's almost 3 hours long and I only looked at my watch once, and it wasn't because I was bored. I just, you know, wanted to have a sense of how close are we to the ending, to gauge possibilities of ending. The only thing that I find a quibble is actually the visuals, really, because, you know, they're wonderful. But I think there's an element, or I keep wondering, it's a question, it's not a view, but it is a question. I keep wondering if maybe a better director would have made the images resonate more, right? So, for example, when you see those square weapons, you know, tanks or whatever, ships, whatever they are, kind of, you know, in the landscape, you think, oh, you know, it's a cool design idea. It's like a spaceship like you've never seen one before, you know. But it doesn't quite symbolize other things, or, you know, kind of the image doesn't resonate. It just looks kind of cool and weird, right?
I know what you mean.
So I was wondering about that a little bit.
I was talking to this about Matt the other day, in fact. We were talking about, I suppose, this coming up, and we were talking about Denis Villeneuve, and I was thinking, how many of his images throughout his films really stay with you and resonate? Like, I respect them all and they all look amazing. But the only one I think I kind of return to mentally is the stuff in Blade Runner 2049, where it's the sex scene with the prostitutes and the hologram interlinking. And that was in 3D as well. And it just looked, I couldn't understand how they'd done it. You know? And I remember, I don't think I've watched that since, but it stayed in my head.
Yes, but I love that film.
But that's the only imagery of his. Maybe the imagery in the in Arrival as well, of the big rectangular window,
yes,
behind which the aliens stand and their hands and, you know, the ghostliness, that stuff as well. I think.
Yes.
So that's, but then, but despite the fact that his that his imagery is considered and beautiful, and obviously so much work goes into it, it doesn't stay with me.
No, I mean, so that's my quibble, yeah. You know, because kind of you want the visuals to be poetic, you know, to stand in for something or to resonate, but also to kind of convey emotion. Like, you know, I mean, I thought with those stupid helicopter airplanes with the wings that go in all directions, you think, oh, that's like a helicopter that you've never seen. You know, is it meant to symbolize a pesky fly or whatever? You know, but in that case, you know, they're so big and burdensome and, you know, like, it's not a good design. And
to be fair, I think it's from the books, which doesn't mean they can't change it.
Yeah.
But,
well, to me,
I mean, if they changed it, then the fans would be very upset.
Yeah. Anyway, I was trying to figure out kind of, you know, if there was a symbology behind the imagery, you know, and maybe there is, and, you know, I'm just not getting it really. But I did think that, you know, are they just pretty images? Yeah, because they don't carry the weight of emotion or meaning in the way that kind of the great directors really do. So that's just a question.
There is a kind of thematic weight that some things have, but it does feel very general. Things like the way that the sandworms are kind of like the guardians of treasure on this planet. You know, it's like dragons from mythology. They have that kind of feeling, but it's in a slightly different setting and they're different kinds of creatures. But they have that same function. There are things like that that are going on all throughout this. I mean, Paul is a kind of, well, he's a messiah figure. Or he's at least being built as a kind of messiah figure. And there's the whole thing about warring families and the bloodlines and so on, which are these kind of big, epic aspects of storytelling that have been in stories since, like, Beowulf and before, you know, are all here, but they all also feel kind of general, and they just sell kind of epicness.
I liked it, and I followed it, and I found it exciting, but also kind of superficial. So, you know, if you are buying into, or if you're setting up something as being both medieval but mythological and with God involved, or with some otherworldly mystical element.
Potentially.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, it has it. The high priestesses and so on, I mean, within the terms of the world, they're real. So there should be the sense of horror, of fear, yeah, of things beyond your control, right? You never get that sense of wildness, of potentiality, like, you know, kind of, I mean, part of the ways that horror works is because if you accept that there is another world or other worlds or spirits or, yeah, those things are very scary, right? You know, and there's never that sense of, you know, a kind of an internal terror that's externalized in the body of this film. I mean, even in the moment where, like, people were being killed, you actually don't think, you know, that it's particularly brutal the way that, you know, you would expect in a medieval fight, yeah?
The film is always cutting away from those moments.
Yeah.
Which really bothers me. Well, you say, no, bothers is too strongly. But when the film starts, and it starts with the title card and it says 12A, I'm like, so we're not going to see anything really juicy, you know? And then every time the film gets to one of those moments, it cuts away just when you know the person's going to be executed, set on fire, whatever it is. I'd really rather see that stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, I normally don't mind either way.
Yeah.
But the thing is that this is a world in which, you know, the otherworldly should be terrorizing, or the unknown should be terrorizing. In fact, physical, you know, battles should be terrorizing, right? Like, you know, and there's none of that sense of horror that you should be feeling at different moments.
This maybe comes a little bit back round to what I was asking about. Do you think the film really, really is allowing for the supernatural and the idea of a real messiah? Because you offered reasons why it is allowing for that, and yes. You know, but I think the film is always also hedging against those things. Like, it offers explanations for why people survive the poison ritual. Like I say, I think he's always making a bit of a joke about Javier Bardem's belief. you know, one of the trials on which he sends Paul, the first one he does, you know, with these tests that only the Messiah will pass, is go out into the desert and basically live for a while without dying. Mm. It was essentially what I could get from that. And he doesn't do it on his own. Zendaya comes and helps him, you know. So the film is kind of offering reasons to not quite buy this. And then on top of that, you know, you talk about the priestesses, the Bene Gesserit people. Yeah. They're clearly conniving, scheming people. Like, I find it also very easy to believe, and I think, again, the film builds in this possibility that everything about them is about just the control. And that a way to control people is going to be through belief.
No, I think you're meant to believe that they see the future, that they can hypnotize people, that they command people's minds.
Yeah. I mean, although, isn't that also all... generally speaking, explained through particularly spice, but kind of drugs and psychedelics and things like that.
Well, that's an element of it, but, you know, they also do that via the position that they hold. I mean, you know, the way that it's explained is, you know, kind of when you take on the role of this grand priestess, you also have access to all of their lives, right? So you have all this pain and terror of, like, you know, so you're meant to, that is meant to be true in the film. That's not meant to be a trick or a sleight of the hand that they make. Other people believe they have that power, but they don't actually.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I get you. I'm with you. And I'm not completely disagreeing with you, but I mean, what you're saying about the inability to buy into a much larger sense of the supernatural, unreal, otherworldly, may be part of that.
Well,
I think a modern film that wants you to buy into that would kind of be laughed at a bit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, frankly, I think this might be a disjunction of the director wanting to use all of these elements in the film and using them, you know, and knowing how to use them because, you know, he's a Quebecois director, so he grew up in a culture intimately familiar with Catholic rituals and histories and so on, but actually of that generation, you know, post the Quiet Revolution, that no longer believes, right? And so actually this thing of like not believing, but, you know, knowing that world in which those beliefs are, you know, do hold sway, that might be a reason why, you know, the film is deploying all of those things as if they were real, but actually it's not conveying any of the horror or fear or terror of that reality. Maybe.
Yeah. So, yeah. Despite the fact the film is so big and so long and has so much in it, I kind of almost feel that I've already come to the end of my thoughts on it because it really was marvellous in the moment to watch. Despite the fact, I mean, I was bored at certain points. I think it lulls and there were things I was less interested in and so on, but it never stopped looking amazing. That was constant. I know I'm constantly going back to that, but it was continually a source of pleasure for me. It was worth seeing it on that screen. Seeing it at the cinema.
Oh, completely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it really, really is. Yeah. Like, the film kind of, it has, and Denis Villeneuve, I think, has such respect for the cinematic experience and the cinematic image. And I also think you got that from the audience. You know, it was a very full audience.
Yes.
The screen must have been 2/3 or more full. We only got tickets on the edge of the, you know, we couldn't get them in the middle because it was pretty much packed out. And, you know, the past few times I've been in audiences that full have basically been for Marvel and Star Wars films. And there's always someone on their phone. You know, and there was none of that here, right? These people were here because they were grown ups and they wanted to watch the movie and they wanted to go to the cinema for a cinematic experience. And I know that seems like kind of a low bar, but it's a difference, right? You know, it was good with, despite the fact the audience was essentially making no noise because they were just watching the film. It's different with a big audience, you know, and it played really well, you know.
Yes, and I'll say I kind of. I loved watching it, but I have to think some more about whether it's a great film or not, kind of. It doesn't feel like one now, really, at the moment. Yeah. No.
Well, you wouldn't get that out of me, but I didn't like the first one very much, and I do think it's a really good sequel. I mean, it builds on what the first film did in all the places that it needs to, and it improves on them where it needs to. It is more exciting and more interesting, and I think it's going to be more memorable to me. If only because the first one was so unmemorable to me. But, you know, I don't want to kind of damn it with faint praise. I think it's good, and I liked it.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I liked it very much, and I highly recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, only see it if you've already seen Madam Web, because that's the film of the season.
Yeah, right. Anyway, we'll end here. We might return to it, actually. I mean, I think that there's probably, like, you know, things to think through. But after 3 hours of the film, my brain isn't kind of functioning at the level where it would just kind of tease them out. So.
Well, I'm sure there are, but also I think so much of that probably comes from the source material. And you've got to bear in mind the source material is from 1965. It is decades old at this point, and it's kind of well-worn. And there were several sequels, which I think if they make a third, which seems reasonably likely, because this film's doing well. So these two films are based on the first Dune novel, and I think a third film would be based on the next one. I think it's called Dune Messiah. And, you know, obviously, I think it's rather like Star Wars, you know. I like Star Wars and I get the stuff in Star Wars. And if you don't and you're not that interested, nothing will make you that interested because it's just not your cup of tea. And I do think, like, Dune is just something that has passed me by throughout my life. And I will never become more interested in it than I am now, which is not great at all.
Well, I think you're pretty interested. And like you said, you know, it's kind of a spectacular experience at the cinema. And it's really entertaining. I didn't feel the 3 hours at all. It's a really good sequel. And it's the best kind of sequel. Because actually, if you haven't seen the first part, you can actually make sense of the second part. So I really recommend that everyone see it.
Yeah, I wouldn't... Not to carry on too long, but I wouldn't emphasize how much you can make sense of the sequel without seeing the first, because I was struggling. Like I say, I was following the broad strokes, but I was constantly going, I don't know why they're doing this. I don't know. I don't care. But it's fine because there's a big worm. I was waiting for the thing with the three worms. I wanted to know when that was going to show up. And of course it shows up right at the fucking end. It made me wait. But, you know, eventually I got my three worms.
But your three worms worth.
Yeah. But I wouldn't overdo how legible it is to someone who is unfamiliar with what it's telling you. But apart from that, I mean, it's a really watchable movie, yeah.
All right, well, thank you all very much for listening. We're Eavesdropping at the Movies, and we are on
Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and YouTube. On social media, we're on Facebook and Twitter at Eavesdrop Movies, and Blue Sky, eavesdropping.bsky.social, and the website is eavesdroppingatthemovies.com.
Great, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. I also think, just quickly, I wonder if you agree with this, the fight, the duel at the end between Butler and Paul, I think the film cops out a little bit in not showing you the killing blow, because he gets his hand on the blade, and then off screen he's turned it round and stabbed him, and I'm going, you need to show me how he did that, because that looks fucking impossible. And also, because they started the fight by saying, may your blade splinter and smash, or whatever it is, I thought that it might go, like, he broke the blade and did it.
I agree.
But they didn't do that.